Hello, Peter Mayers with you in the National Interest on ABC Radio National. Coming up, capping and terminating visas. A bill before Parliament would give the Immigration Minister sweeping powers to clear a massive backlog of migration applications. And keeping state secrets. What we're still not allowed to know about East Timor 35 years on. The National Interest Roundup begins in the national capital, where alfresco dining is under threat. At least that's the conclusion of the Canberra Times, which reports that new guidelines for outdoor eateries could kill the city's burgeoning cafe culture. The ACT government has released for public comment 25 pages of draft guidelines for regulating how restaurant tables are placed on footpaths. For example, dining furniture must be attractive and interesting in appearance, and signage should celebrate the activity of outdoor eating without allowing advertising to dominate, particularly brand and corporate advertising. What? No coffee company logos on the outdoor umbrellas? The ACT opposition says the rules are overly bureaucratic and will stifle any chance of Canberra developing a cosmopolitan atmosphere. But at least they might make it easier to get around. The guidelines stipulate that a 3-metre-wide strip of unobstructed footpath should be maintained at all times. Compared to where I live in Melbourne, that sounds like a veritable highway. And as a pedestrian, it sounds pretty good. But I reckon your coffee might get cold on the way to the table. In Brisbane, the City Council has come up with a novel initiative, an amnesty for library fine defaulters who make penance in the form of a can of beans, or perhaps a tin of tomatoes. Lord Mayor Campbell Newman says the council will waive more than $1.4 million in library fines as long as those who are tardy returning their books make a donation to Food Bank, a service that distributes food to welfare agencies and needy families. People need just take a can of tinned food and any unreturned books to their local library, and all will be forgiven. But they must do so before the end of the month. As you've no doubt heard, Victoria is to get a permanent anti-corruption commission after Premier John, don't call it a backflip, Brumby, dropped his long-standing opposition to the idea. And that leaves just one state, South Australia, without a corruption watchdog. Premier Brumby's decision comes ahead of November's state election, but SA has already been to the polls this year. During the campaign, Premier Mike Rann maintained that what was needed was a national graft and corruption agency, not a separate state-based body. However, as constitutional law expert Professor Greg Craven asked rhetorically in the Advertiser, why would any state want to invite another government to check on whether it's doing a good job? South Australia should take responsibility for the smells from its own kitchen, he said. And indeed, even in South Australia, something seems to be cooking. New Attorney General John Rau has promised a review of the state's existing accountability mechanisms to check they're working as effectively and efficiently as possible. One thing's for sure, though. If South Australia too gets a corruption watchdog, the state government will deny it's done a policy backflip. A bill introduced to federal parliament last week would give the immigration minister significant new powers, enabling him to clear out a huge backlog of visa applications. There are currently 147,000 valid applications for general skilled migration in the processing pipeline. More than a quarter of the people in that queue are foreign students who've applied for permanent residency after graduating from Australian colleges and universities. Many qualified as cooks and hairdressers, occupations the federal government says are no longer in short supply in Australia. The bill before Parliament would enable the minister to cap the number of visas issued each year to particular groups, like cooks or hairdressers, for example. When that cap is reached, all other applications in the queue are terminated. That means they'll be treated as if they'd never been made. If the applicant is in Australia, their bridging visa will cease and they'll have 28 days to pack up and leave. While the proposed visa capping bill hasn't been much reported in the mainstream media, news has spread rapidly through migration websites and international student networks, provoking considerable anxiety. One person worried about the bill and potentially affected by it is Julie Beaumont, who came to Australia from the UK with her husband and son in 2006. She studied hairdressing at a private college and After qualifying in her chosen trade, she applied for permanent residency. That was 18 months ago, and she's been in the migration queue ever since. Julie Beaumont, welcome to the National Interest.
Thank you.
Why did you come to Australia?
For a better life for all of us. A sea change. A change is as good as a rest.
And why hairdressing?
I'd been in office work ever since I left school, and I had a study options, and they came and said, these are the trades, pick one.
These are the trades Australia wants, essentially.
Yeah, they were in demand, so I chose hairdressing because I thought it's something completely different, totally, totally different to what we used to before. So, yeah.
And what was your initial experience of study like?
I was scared. I was probably one of the oldest ones in class as well, but I enjoy it. I love it.
But the first school you went to?
Yeah, the first school was not good. It were overcrowded. I believe that it was just a visa school, especially when I heard one of the teachers saying, pretend to cut it because this girl was struggling. Just pretend to cut it and, we'll pass you off as competent.
She was being tested and she was told just to pretend to cut the hair and that she'd be ticked off as competent.
Yeah.
You witnessed that?
Yeah, I witnessed that, yeah. And I got together with a couple of other girls, the teacher actually said it to her, and all three of us went along to immigration because I wanted to do it as a trade after school. I wasn't going to pay X thousands of dollars, not to do it after.
How much did you actually pay for that course?
I paid for the first one $10,000.
$10,000.
And I left after six.
After
with
6 months.
Refund.
So you spent $10,000, you stayed there 6 months, you decided it was nothing more than a visa factory,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you left.
Yeah.
And you told immigration that it was a visa factory.
Yeah.
And what did they do?
Well, nothing as far as I know, because it's still up and running. So
the same school?
Yeah, the same school, yeah. But they just said that I was able to move and that I could get RPL.
Recognition of prior learning. Yeah.
But because I didn't want to do that, because I didn't even know if I'd been taught correctly, I'd never been in that trade, so I didn't know. So,
didn't know whether you'd learned anything worthwhile.
So I started all over again.
At a new school?
Yeah, new school and paid $17,000.
And how was the new school?
Great. Lots of customers, giving you that exposure. I certainly wouldn't have been ready after that first school if I would have stayed. No way, because there were no customers.
And so you completed your course after another year?
It were about 16 months.
18, right.
16 months, I think it was, yeah.
And since then, you've been able to find work?
Yeah, I got me work experience in a shop and she took me straight on after I'd finished.
So you got a permanent job straight away?
Permanent job, yeah.
And when did you apply for permanent residency
January
in Australia?
January 2009.
So you've been in the queue now for 18 months?
Yeah.
And what were you told when you applied?
That it'd probably be between, it might be 4 months, but bank on 6 months.
Until you got the
extra
visa?
Yeah. Until we got as permanent. But then the goalposts started changing.
Well, the government has introduced a number of changes since then in priority processing and other changes. And what are your concerns about the new bill before Parliament, the visa capping amendment bill?
My main concern is, not all three of us want to stay here. We've built a new life here. We've got friends.
This is your husband and son.
Yeah, we've both got jobs. Daniel wants to do an apprenticeship.
That's your son.
So everything's here now. There's nothing really in England for us. Yeah, there's his friends and his family. But when you start and you build a new life for yourself, it's hard to go back to your old life.
So how old's your son?
He's 19.
And he wants to do an apprenticeship. Why can't he?
Because he's not permanent. No one will take him on.
Because they don't know that he'll be able to stay in Australia?
Yeah, because it comes up that he's a temporary resident. So, school fees and stuff like that, it just complicates it. So they just say no.
The Australian government says we have enough cooks and enough hairdressers like you.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we need more, we can train young Australians who are unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
So, fair enough, isn't it, that you should take your skills back home and use them in the UK?
It is fair enough, but when I applied, it was in demand. It was a wanted occupation. So I can see from now, if the bill comes in, take it from now, do the capping and the ceasing from the 17th onwards.
Into
but
the
not
future.
For everyone that's been waiting. It's just not fair.
Did anyone ever tell you you would be guaranteed permanent residency in Australia?
No, it's never guaranteed. We know that, and we knew that that were a massive risk to take. But when you sat and your application goes in and they say 4 to 6 months and you should have it, then you think, well, you know, we're definitely in now.
And you were encouraged to come to Australia in the first place because you were told there were skills that were needed.
Yep. We'd been on holidays before, loved it. Every time we came, we kept looking around, you know, different areas. And then we just said, right, let's, you know, go for it. And hairdressing, cooks, they were all on the list. Accountancy, but I didn't want to do anything office-based. I needed something completely different for a new start.
How much have you invested in trying to create a new life for yourselves in Australia?
With the schooling, my schooling alone was $27,000. My son's was $20,000, and that was a public school, not a private one.
So that's just to go to a government school in Victoria?
Yeah.
Because he's not a permanent resident?
Yeah, so you have to pay international student rates. Transport, cars, you know. The 20 hours for the first 2 years of the student visa was tough, very tough.
Because for the first 2 years as a student, you could only work 20 hours a week, and your husband could also only work 20 hours a week.
Which is difficult to get as well, because part-time's not 20 hours, it's more than 20 hours. So it's, you know, you kind of get hit all around. We transferred probably about $130,000 over here.
From the UK.
And it's gone.
Where did that money come from?
From our mortgage. We actually remortgaged our house in England, which is now rented out. So if we go back, we've got nowhere to live for 12 months anyway.
And you're $130,000 out of pocket.
Yep.
And your husband, he's been able to find work?
Yeah, he has now, when he's settled, yeah.
And because since you applied for permanent residency, he's been able to work full-time?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you see the future?
At this minute, bleak. But we're trying to stay on the positive side, you know, that someone's got a heart and they actually look, rather than just say, we're ceasing these. You've got to let people have an appeal. It can't just be capped and ceased, you know, it's not fair.
And Julie, what would have happened, do you think, if you'd stayed at the original school, the dodgy school that you went to in the first place?
I would have passed. No, I'm almost positive I would have done. You know, I would have got my job anyway, because I got my job that I'm in now through a friend at that school.
And then you would have been able to apply for permanent residency a year six months earlier.
And that would have made a major difference, especially to me, 6 months, yeah.
Because now you'd have...
I'd have probably got permanent, yeah.
Julie Beaumont, thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Beaumont, who came from the UK to Australia to study hairdressing. This is The National Interest on ABC Radio National. The Migration Amendment Visa Capping Bill 2010, the bill we've been talking about, has been referred to the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee for consideration. The committee is due to report in 11 days' time, which could enable the bill to be passed in the winter session of Parliament. That is, it could become law before the federal election. Joining me to discuss the bill and what he'll do with his new powers if it is passed is Immigration Minister Senator Chris Evans. Senator Evans, welcome to The National Interest.
Thank you very much.
Senator Evans, we've just spoken to Julie Beaumont, who came to Australia from the UK in 2006, qualified here as a hairdresser and applied 18 months ago for permanent residency. With this bill before the Parliament, should she be packing her bags and preparing to move back to the UK?
No, she shouldn't, Peter. Some of the reporting on this bill seems to be a bit hysterical and inflammatory. This is just about making sure we have the ability to manage the program. We've announced our policy in relation to students and the management of their issues, but we have made it very clear that Australia is going to select people that it needs to fill the skills program, not people who just happen to nominate. And part of the succession of changes we're making is to make sure we move to a demand-driven, not a supply-driven system. And this is just another element of those changes.
But when the Parliamentary Secretary, Laurie Ferguson, introduced this bill to the House of Representatives, he made specific reference to the large number of cooks and hairdressers in the migration queue. Now, if I had read that in Hansard or heard it reported, and I was in the queue as a cook or a hairdresser, I'd be worried.
Yeah, but you would have also heard my comments on the February the 8th when I went through the transitional arrangement about the pathways for current students onshore and current graduates onshore. that they had an opportunity to find a pathway to permanency by making sure they had the proper skills, that they had adequate English, and they had a connection to the labour force that allowed them to work in that skilled area. So there are pathways for people. What Laurie Ferguson, the Parliamentary Secretary, was saying was, quite clearly, we're not going to run a program, say, of 40,000 of general skilled migration per year, and then find that 30,000 of them are cooks and hairdressers. That's clearly ludicrous. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we manage the program, we get an appropriate mix of skills that Australia needs.
So are you saying these changes will only operate in the future and not to people already in the queue?
Well, Peter, I read an article you wrote, and I think it's actually adding to a bit of hysteria. I've made it very clear what the rules are regarding students, and people ought to look at those. There are pathways for people currently on shore. But we've also made it very clear that people are not going to be able to just come to Australia to buy an education and get a guaranteed migration pathway in future. They're going to have schools we need and be employable. So those changes are happening. This is a bill that gives the minister the power to deal with situations where we're getting too many people in one occupation distorting the program, and to allow us effectively to deal with applications where people have no chance of being selected for migration if people are in an occupation or in a group where there's no chance of them coming through in the system. As you know, we did that earlier with the group of people who are offshore who had lodged pre-September 2007. They had no chance of becoming migrants to this country, and we used that power then to ensure they got their refund and knew where they stood. But this is a power that we would use very, very rarely if we need to manage the program in that way.
I understand that you've said you would use the power judiciously and rarely, but Minister, you may not be Minister by the end of the year. Other Ministers may choose to use these powers more dramatically.
Well, they may do, and they would obviously then have to argue that case in public. But
they'd have the powers.
Well, there's a Senate committee inquiry going on. We're looking at the feedback from that. The committee will no doubt take all that into account in reporting, and I will consider that report seriously. I mean, that's the great strength of the Senate committee process. So I'm not saying we've made the final word on these things. I'm a great defender of the Senate committee process, and if it throws up issues that we need to address, we'll address them.
One of the issues that occurred to me would be that you can identify any particular group to apply these measures to, and you can then cap the number of visas issued to that group and terminate all applications currently in the queue. Now, we've talked about particular occupations like hairdressers and cooks, but conceivably that could also be used to cap and terminate visas applied for by people of a particular nationality.
No, look, Peter, I think that would potentially run foul of discrimination law. I think people ought to...
But these are non-citizens we're talking about. They wouldn't necessarily be covered by Australia's anti-discrimination
law. No, but we've got international obligations as well. Look, Peter, this is not what this is about. I think you know that.
I do know that, Minister, and I absolutely believe that that's not what your intention is. But my point is these powers are going to be there for the future. Wouldn't a future minister have those powers?
Well, whatever's passed by the Parliament, whatever's eventually passed by the Parliament, will reflect the will of the Parliament and will become law. That's right. And we're at the start of that process. We're obviously open to any feedback on the bill, and we'll have to go through the appropriate parliamentary process.
But, so, is there anything in this bill or in the Migration Act at the moment that would stop, say, a future minister saying, "Well, we've had enough applications from India for this year. We don't want any more"?
My advice is that would be discriminatory. We're looking to be able to cap and cease on the basis of occupation, the date of application, perhaps English level. This power will actually become redundant in a few years' time, in the sense that we're moving to a selection model. What we've got at the moment is problems brought about by the fact that people can apply for migration to this country, meet the minimum requirements, and then come in, if you like, or be processed in order of application. That's meant we haven't been actually tailoring the program to meet our skill needs. Now, in future, we're looking to move to a selection model, and under that model, you wouldn't need this power because you'd be selecting those that you needed in the occupations and with the skills that you need. At the moment, we've just got this queue where we had the ridiculous situation where we were bringing in thousands of cooks and doctors and engineers were stuck in the queue behind them. This is just part of managing that process better. But in terms of the people onshore who've been students, etc., there are pathways for them, but they have to make sure they can prove they've got skills, they can prove that they can speak English, and they prove that they're actually going to add to our workforce by working in that skilled area.
What about the migrants who are in the queue who are offshore, because there are tens of thousands of them as well? Will you use these powers to reduce the queue of offshore applications, people who are applying from other countries overseas?
Well, look, we've got the power to use it onshore or offshore, but what we did with that cohort who'd applied pre-September 2007 is we did cap and cease, if you like, because they were never going to come through the system. This is really to deal with the fact that you've got people queued who may never actually get to migrate to Australia, and they're just left in the queue with their fees unrefunded. And that's the result of the fact that we allow people just to join the queue because they meet a basic qualification. We're fundamentally trying to change that system. This is a power that may be useful in making that transition. But when we get to the final reform destination, a selection method will mean that this is effectively unnecessary. But it may suit people for us to cap and cease them on occasions, because if they're never going to get there, they'd be better off getting their money back.
At least they get their application feedback. But, yep. Minister, I'm a bit confused, because you say on the one hand this is all looking to the future, so we make sure we don't get into this mess again with a very big queue, 2 years' worth of applicants backlogged. But the bill itself isn't only applied to the future. You yourself are saying the queue is the problem. So are you going to use this cap and cease bill to get rid of the backlog or not?
Well, we're giving ourselves the power. That's the idea of the legislation. I don't want to mislead you. It does give us the power. I think we'll be able to manage the pipeline in other ways, but it does allow us to deal with the fact that if we have 40,000 accountants in a queue and we only want a couple of thousand a year, that we might want to take some action in that regard. But the main focus and the hysteria that seems to be growing around this has been based on those students onshore. And we announced back in February the rules that would apply to them, how they could find a pathway to permanent residency. But I stress the change in the system is there fundamentally to say we will select the applicants we need. And that is causing some dislocation and some disappointment for people, but I don't resile from that. We're not going to run a system whereby the system which we inherited, which effectively said we have no control over the skills that come into the country.
Minister, as you've pointed out, people whose visa applications are capped and terminated will get the charges they've paid to the government back, but they still could be thousands of dollars out of pocket for other fees like migration advice and health checks and qualifications recognition and so on. And they also will have no right to appeal this decision, will they?
No, not if they're capped and ceased. But the alternative, Peter, is I just leave them in the queue, use my other powers to cap and queue or to priority process and treat them even worse by saying you're not going to get your money back, but I'm going to leave you there forever. I mean, at least this way, if we use it, it'll be giving people some certainty. Those people who were offshore pre-September 2007 who were capped and ceased were just left there with their money not refunded, going nowhere. They were never going to come to Australia under those current applications. So I'd argue if you're not going to allow them to migrate to Australia, you're better off being upfront with them and refunding their money.
Minister, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Immigration Minister Senator Chris Evans. And as he said, the Migration Amendment Visa Capping Bill has been referred to the Senate's Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee. You'll find a link to its inquiry on the National Interest website, abc.net.au/rn/national interest, where you can click the Add Your Comment tag on this story to give us your thoughts, or call the feedback line 1300 936 222. This is the National Interest on ABC Radio National. Mark Webster is a registered migration agent, and he's the president of the Migration Institute of Australia for New South Wales and the ACT. For obvious professional reasons, he's also taken a close interest in the visa capping bill before Parliament. Mark Webster joins me from our Sydney studios. Mark Webster, welcome.
Hello, Peter.
Let's just spell out, what are the powers the minister is seeking under this bill?
Okay, so what the minister would be able to do under this bill would be to announce a cap. And that cap would apply to certain classes of people.
And he'd be able to identify who those classes of people were.
Correct. And he's mentioned a couple of examples of the ways that he's envisioning this being used. For instance, classifying by how long they've been in the queue, what occupation they're in, and what sort of English language ability they have.
And so once he's identified them and once he says, OK, we've put that cap at 200 places or whatever it is, we've now accepted 200 migrants in that from that category, all other applications are, to use the words in the legislation, terminated.
Yes, they're terminated, and the fees are returned to the applicant, and the application is treated as having never been made.
Now, as you heard, the minister says the fears building up around these measures amongst international students and student graduates in Australia verge on the hysterical. Are you able, having heard what the minister said, to reassure your clients that they don't need to be worried about this bill?
Well, the minister's comments are very encouraging in that I didn't hear anything that says that he is definitely considering capping and ceasing the people onshore. He does seem to be aware that people who are here and who've studied here have invested a huge amount of money, and to cap and cease and send them home after 28 days will cause a lot of grief to those people. But then again, in this bill, there is specific provision for what happens to those people who are onshore. So under this bill, the minister or a future minister who may not have that intention that Senator Evans has would be able to send those people home.
Well, because, of course, there is an election coming, so Senator Evans may not be immigration minister next year or later on.
That's right. I mean, he obviously has all the best intentions for those people onshore at the moment, but things change. And if we're looking at the migration program, the program today is very different to the program 18 months ago. And the economic situation is also quite different. So, look, things very, very quickly change. And what a current minister intends to do is not binding on a future minister.
The minister talked about transitional arrangements in place to allow foreign students or student graduates who are already here to still achieve permanent residency. Now, how do those pathways work?
Okay, now the first thing I've got to say is that the most important transitional provision only applies to a very small number of people. Now, let me explain exactly what's happened. The minister has made a decision to very much restrict what they call the skilled occupations list. And what happens there is that the occupations that they're worried about, like cooks and hairdressers, are not on that new skilled occupations list.
And that's a list that, of occupations that are in demand in or in shortage in the Australian economy.
That's correct.
And the list, I think, has been cut from about 400 to 180.
That's correct. So if you're going to apply for permanent residence from now on, you need to have an occupation on that new skilled occupations list if you're going for what they call general skilled migration. And so only a very small number of students are actually able to apply now if they're not on the skilled occupations list.
But what if they've already applied, so they're already in the pipeline? They'll be treated under the old rules and the old list?
Correct, unless they're capped and ceased under this power that's under the bill.
So in theory, if they get processed, then they should be able to get permanent residency.
That's right. So everybody that's lodged now, well, the vast majority, I would say, have applied under the current under the regulations that applied at the date that they lodged. And so unless something changes in terms of a cap and cease, they would normally be granted their visas.
But we also know that they haven't been being processed because the government also brought in something called priority processing arrangements, and that meant that, as the minister mentioned, he wanted to bring doctors and engineers and others to the front of the queue.
That's right. And the change that the minister made was actually very significant because the previous system was more or less a first-in, first-served system with some level of prioritisation based on occupation. But previously, we could lodge an application, and if we thought that they met the criteria at the time of application, we were fairly sure that they would be getting their visa in the end. Now, the change that the minister made basically meant that there was a very strict prioritisation. So if you're on the critical skills list, which was a shorter list than the skilled list, you were processed very quickly. But if you weren't on that list, you could be waiting, I think the minister put it last time he was on your show, where they could be waiting 20 to 30 years for their visa or not get it at all.
This new set of arrangements that's being proposed in the bill applies initially, or has been described as applying, to general skilled migration, but could it apply to other kinds of migration, like family migration?
It can, certainly. There is nothing in this bill that says that it only applies to general skilled migration. And in fact, there are some parts of it that seem to contemplate this bill being applied in situations where somebody has applied for a partner visa.
That is, to bring in a spouse.
That's correct.
But the minister's not making any suggestion that he's going to do that.
Not at this point, no.
But again, the powers would be there.
And this is our concern, really. The minister obviously is introducing this for a particular purpose. The problem that I and a lot of other people have with it is that it really does go a long way beyond what seems to be necessary to manage the general skilled program. For one thing, it affects every type of visa application, potentially. For another thing, it really does affect the operation of the lawmaking system in migration law, because the minister can retrospectively say, well, we're not going to grant your visa anymore, and apply arbitrary criteria without having that oversighted by Parliament at all. And how the current system works is that if the minister wants to change a subclass, he needs the consent of the Governor-General, and that can be struck down by Parliament if Parliament thinks that there's a problem with that new regulation.
And that wouldn't be the case under the new rules?
Correct, because the minister could say, well, actually, we've got a problem here. We'll introduce some criteria so that if somebody doesn't meet the kind of person that we think should be granted a visa, we'll cap and cease their application and everybody will have their application returned.
Very briefly, Mark, I raised the concern with the minister that it could be used by a future minister to restrict categories of nationality. Is that a concern, do you think? Or am I being hysterical?
I think I'm concerned about it, and I would really like to take some time and see whether the Racial Discrimination Act actually applies to the migration program or not. The minister has recently made a change to the processing priorities for the refugee program based on nationality, for instance.
Indeed, involving the Afghans and Sri Lankans. Mark, I'm sorry, we'll have to leave it there. Migration agent Mark Webster, who's the New South Wales and ACT president of the Migration Institute of Australia. Again, we welcome your feedback. Click the Add Your Comment tag on this story on the website, abc.net.au/rn/national interest, or call the feedback line, 1300 936 222.
ABC Radio National is once again inviting Australia's regional museums to tell us why they're the best in the country. If you're a volunteer or work at a museum, or just love your local regional one, we want to hear from you. We're interested in how museums tell their particular story, contribute to our understanding and to their communities. Also tell us how they're working to secure their future. The 2010 Regional Museums Award. Find all the nomination details on the Radio National website.
A Canberra-based academic is taking on the Department of Defence in a bid to gain access to documents written about East Timor almost 35 years ago. Dr. Clinton Fernandez is a lecturer in international relations at the Australian Defence Force Academy at the University of New South Wales and a former Army major and intelligence officer. He's seeking access to 41 situation reports written about Portuguese Timor, as it was then known, shortly before the Indonesian invasion of December 1975. These situation reports summarised the intelligence gathered at the time so it could be circulated to a select group of government officials. Most documents of this nature are released after 30 years, but the Defence Department says these 1975 situation reports can't be made public because they could still damage the security, defence or international relations of the Commonwealth in 2010. Dr. Fernandez has been seeking the documents through Freedom of Information for 3 years, and the matter will now be decided by the Administrative Appeals Tribunal in a hearing to be held in August. To discuss the issue, Clinton Fernandez joins me from Sydney. Dr. Fernandez, welcome to the National Interest.
Good to be with you.
And joining us from the ABC's Port Macquarie studios is Robert Oakeshott. He's the independent MP for the federal seat of Lyne on the north coast of New South Wales, and he's raised this issue in Parliament. Mr. Oakeshott, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Clinton Fernandez, first of all, do you know what's in these 41 situation reports that you're seeking access to?
Yes, I do.
How do you know if you haven't got them yet?
Well, I'm a former intelligence officer, and in the 1990s, I was the principal analyst on East Timor for the Australian Intelligence Corps. I can't describe their precise contents to you because I'm still bound by rules of secrecy.
So you've seen them, you know what's in them,
yes.
But you can't talk about what's in them unless they're publicly released to you.
Well, I can't describe their specific contents, no.
Can you give us an idea of what they tell us about Timor in 75 that we don't already know?
Well, I can tell you that these documents are the Joint Intelligence Organization's intelligence assessments on East Timor. They show the Indonesian military's activities during this period. The Indonesian military was claiming at the time that it wasn't involved in the attack on Timor, but that some patriotic Indonesian volunteers were just helping out the Timorese. Now, even the Indonesian government today doesn't claim this. What those documents would show is the activities of the Indonesian military, the subsequent knowledge that we had about the killings of five journalists at Balabo and the killing of a sixth journalist in Dili, and they would show the military effectiveness of the Indonesians.
As I understand it, there are two sections of the Archive Act that are being used to block the release of these documents to you. What are the legal reasons given for not releasing them to you?
The two sections are section 33(1)(a) and 33(1)(b). 33(1)(a) basically says that it would cause damage to the security, defense, or international relations of the Commonwealth. And 33(1)(b) says that some of the material has been given to us by a foreign government. And so we then have a treaty obligation to not disclose that material. I should say that I completely accept the second reason. Any material that's been provided by a foreign government, even if it's the number of paper clips that were being used, we should not be communicating to anybody, including myself or the public.
So you'd be happy for that to be blacked out or whatever?
Yes, I would. But what I would like is for a word-by-word analysis of the documents to make sure that only the relevant materials provided by a foreign government have been blacked out.
Why do you feel the release of these documents is so important? I mean, you know, the government is saying there are national security questions involved here. We already know an awful lot about what happened in East Timor in 1975. Why are you pushing, continuing to sort of push at this?
Sure. Well, the reason is a historic interest. It's in our national interest, of course, as a country, for us to know the facts about what was going on. It would shed light on our own foreign policy. But it's not just, you know, stirring up trouble. I am actually fighting against bureaucratic inertia. And there is a long history of the bureaucracy pretending that the sky would fall on our heads if certain information came to the public. So the existence of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service was in fact denied until the late 1970s. And for more than two decades, its budget, its existence and its budget was secret. The Auditor General would sign off on a falsified set of documents, you know, showing one set of figures to the public and another set of figures to the confidential internal sources. And guess what? By the late 1970s, when the existence of ACES was no longer a secret, the sky did not fall on our heads. And so bureaucrats have always had this inertia, but this is why we have ministers. I mean, why do we have ministers if not to evaluate critically the claims of bureaucrats?
Robert Oakeshott, as an MP, you've raised this issue twice now in the House of Representatives. Why do you feel it's important?
Well, not only from a historical context that Clinton just mentioned and, you know, having an honest and open debate around what prime ministers were or weren't aware of and what they were aware of, why they dealt with particular issues in a certain way. But I also think it's got a context of the now about it as well, and that is how Australia views itself. And you only need to read Clinton's book to see the dynamics within the current government and how the current prime minister and Laurie Brereton, who was the shadow Foreign Affairs Minister at the time, dealt with our relationships with Indonesia.
I should say this is his book, Reluctant Saviour, looking at the Australian intervention in East Timor in 1999.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, again, without prejudice one way or the other, I think that's got contexts of the now about it and needs to be I think, talked about openly and honestly, and then as well the broader context of how Australia and Australians view ourselves and the relationships with the people around us. You know, this ongoing discussion we seem to have about our relationships with Asia, but Indonesia in particular in this case, and just what is a real sensitivity and what is a perceived sensitivity. And I think on face value, Clinton is presenting a very strong argument that, you know, there's issues within a defence context that are being described as in the national security that, you know, are directly challenging the public interest and the right to know in regards to the overall story of the Australia-Indonesia relationship. And but I don't think it would be a negative. I think it would be a positive for Australia and for Indonesia and for the relationship if we talked openly about some of the difficulties and complexities of the last 35 years.
This is The National Interest on ABC Radio National. I'm speaking to Rob Oakeshott, MP, independent member for the federal seat of Lyne in New South Wales, and also to Dr. Clinton Fernandez, a lecturer in international relations at the University of New South Wales. I should point out we did invite the Minister for Defence, Senator John Faulkner, to discuss this issue on the program. He declined, saying he wouldn't comment before the a hearing at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal later this year. However, he did make the point in Senate estimates that despite the government's reforms to freedom of information, reforms he's been probably more committed to than any other minister, he says, we must understand that certain material that might compromise national security should not be disclosed. Now, Robert Oakeshott, as a Member of Parliament, you have to acknowledge that's a reasonable point, isn't it?
Oh, that is a given. But on face value, here is someone in the case of Clinton Fernandez and others who are saying, as people who have either seen reports or been involved in that process in various forms, saying this question of national security is one worth asking in a context of public interest. Now, 35 years after events, technology has changed in regards to intelligence gathering techniques. So from a defence signals point of view, that has to be questioned.
You mean there's no kind of revealing these documents isn't going to reveal anything about the way we go about gathering intelligence because the techniques are now so outdated?
Yeah, that's right. So Clinton might want to go into more details on that. But from my point of view, that is an obvious change that has happened. And then as well, you know, just a lot of people have either retired from roles or have died. And, you know, I think we can be overly sensitive around this question of national security in a defence context when on a weekly basis at the moment, and for all the right reasons, and I am thankful that you made mention that Senator Faulkner has had a long history of FOI belief.
Freedom of information. Yeah.
Yes, because I think it is to his credit that he has done that, and there are pieces of FOI, of freedom of information legislation going through the Parliament, and everyone in that context is using the language of, you know, we will use as a starting point in our relationship with government the public interest question first. You know, that the starting point and the first principle will be it should be released and work back from there. My response to that has always been this is going to be tested. They're great words, but it will be tested when we get down to the detail and the difficult detail where information released may cause, and I emphasise may cause, political embarrassment of some sort. And I think here we have the very first test case of that, and that belief in a new era of government that deals with freedom of information from a public interest first point of view.
Clinton Fernandez, there can be a fine line here, though, can't there, between political embarrassment and damaging the international relations of the Commonwealth. I mean, the legislation doesn't just talk about national security concerns, it talks about international relations concerns. Now, if the documents you seek were to cause severe political embarrassment in Jakarta, that could damage Australia's relations with Indonesia. Isn't that a legitimate consideration?
No, it's not, because even the Indonesian government no longer maintains that it wasn't involved in Timor. Right. Indonesia, the Indonesian government in power today is the government of Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. President Suharto is now dead. East Timor is now independent. The strategic circumstances have changed so much that it's now a different regional environment. Can I just talk a bit about this business about encryption and secrecy? Because that goes to the heart of what's actually being protected.
That this is the idea about how the intelligence was actually gathered.
Yes. So what was happening was the Defence Signals Directorate was intercepting Indonesian military communications at the time. I am not looking for those intercepts. That's not what my claim is about. I'm looking for the Joint Intelligence Organisation's assessments of what was going on in Timor.
So the summaries.
The summaries or the analysis, the story and its implications, which incorporates the Defence Signals Directorate, signals intercepts. The test is, would Indonesia, 35 years after the event, be able to take countermeasures to go back to the speakers in the military, the speakers that were intercepted, and ask them what specific encryption device they used on a given day? If I was asking for the actual Defense Signals Directorate's signals intercepts, well, that might be arguable. But if I'm looking for the JIO's assessments, the Joint Intelligence Organization's assessments, then it's not possible for the Indonesians to identify 35 years ago which Indonesian officer said what, to whom, on which radio frequency, and with what encryption device. The second point is more technical, but I'll summarize it by saying that the encryption devices used by the Indonesians in 75 became obsolete technology in 1977 when their encryption technology began to be broken by open source journals and mathematicians, and they were published in cryptological journals showing how to break those codes.
So there's nothing secret there now.
Now, no.
Clinton Fernandez, this is going to go now to the Minister of Appeals Tribunal in August, and John Faulkner says, well, you know, that's the umpire, that's where it goes, that's the appropriate place for it to be decided. Will that hearing be an open hearing?
Government has asked that it be a closed hearing, not only to the public, but even to me. They are saying that the affidavits and documents that they are going to tender be seen only by the decision maker at the tribunal, and even I, as the applicant, be excluded. Although I've already seen the documents, I'm not allowed to do it because they're afraid that if I see the documents and ask questions of their witnesses, it'll all come apart. So they're trying to exclude me on national security grounds. Entirely spurious.
And if you get knocked back in August, where do you go next?
Well, I will be going to the Federal Court of Australia.
And how much is this costing you?
At the moment, it's not costing me too much because I'm representing myself. The Administrative Appeals Tribunal is a relatively low-cost way. In the federal court, it becomes a bit more. But what I'm hoping is that as a result of this case and hopefully this program and others like it and the excellent work of Rob Oakeshott, Senator Faulkner, who actually is a pretty decent person, will not be snowed or duchessed by his bureaucrats. I mean, I would hope that he would see the other side of the story, because so far he's only gotten their point of view.
And can I just cut in there? Because the evidence that Senator Faulkner gave to Senate Estimates a few days ago was that he has to be hands-off as a minister and, fully understandable that that's what most ministers say about their portfolios. But ultimately, he could release these papers tomorrow, and I would hope he recognises that he ultimately, as the minister, with the support of potentially a prime minister and a cabinet, could call this case in, have a look at it, and have the papers released.
Robert Oakeshott and Dr. Clinton Fernandez, thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Rob Oakeshott is the independent member for the federal seat of Lyne in New South Wales, and Dr. Clinton Fernandez is a lecturer in international relations at the University of New South Wales, and a former army major who was a key intelligence officer during the 1999 East Timor crisis. As always, we'd welcome your comments. Leave a message on the feedback line, 1300 936 222, or use the Add Your Comment tag on this story on the website at abc.net.au/rn/national interest. Last week on the program, we discussed aged care, which is the subject of an inquiry by the Productivity Commission. Many listeners were taken with my suggestion that there should be a minimum ratio of staff to residents in nursing homes. Greg Mundy, representing not-for-profit aged care providers, said it was difficult to set such a ratio since residents' needs vary widely. This prompted a call from Denise.
I was really pleased to hear the question addressing staff resident ratios, and I always feel that when someone backs back from that question and when they say it can't be done, that means that they don't want to do it. And it is the crucial issue, I think, that has to be grasped. It can be done. You can set minimum standards.
Last week, we also looked at the bid by mining companies to buy the tracks used to haul coal in Queensland. The state government wants to sell Queensland Rail as a vertically integrated enterprise. That is, a single company owning tracks and trains. Miners fear this will create a private monopoly, hence their bid to pay a premium for just the tracks. However, Alan from South Australia says separating the ownership of tracks and trains could cause serious problems, as bad as different states choosing different rail gauges. He says tracks and rolling stock are a single engineering entity.
The separation of control of the rolling stock from the track leads to bad engineering. A glaring example of bad engineering was the break of gauge of Australian railways brought about by conflicting political aims. The separation of control of rolling stock and track would be just as disastrous.
Alan suggests that the coal consortium should bid for all of Queensland Rail, tracks and trains, and then engage the state-owned Australian Rail Track Corporation to manage the infrastructure. Mark wonders why Queensland's coal tracks are being offered as part of the QR sale in the first place.
There is another model for rail privatisation. The former Commonwealth Railways, the National Freight Network and New South Wales Rural Lines. The government retains ownership of the track and infrastructure, whilst private operators pay track access fees to the Australian Rail Track Corporation. This model appears to operate efficiently in Newcastle, the biggest coal port in Australia.
Meanwhile, Ken from Melbourne says debate about selling Queensland Rail has been divorced from the reality of climate change.
The debate falsely assumes that the present trajectory of more coal exports and low levels of rail use for passengers and for other freight purposes will continue indefinitely. There's no mention of the demands of a low-carbon economy. Any bid for QR should have regard to the effects of climate change policy, sustainability, reduced global use of coal and hence coal exports, the shift from road transport to energy-efficient rail, as well as other changes in years to come.
Last week, I also discussed the future of the Tasmanian forests with Premier David Bartlett. The Premier described wood chips as residue from harvesting high-value timber, rather than a primary reason for logging. Tasmanian listener Michael says this simply isn't true.
The forestry, the log trucks go past my house with complete usable saw logs and they head to the wood chip mill.
And Rolf says I should have challenged the Premier's use of the term timber harvesting.
Ever since the logging industry started to employ spin doctors, the term harvesting is used instead of logging because to harvest a crop seems a much more acceptable activity than to cut down trees.
And Paul says the Premier gave the impression that wood products exported by Gunns Limited are now certified by the Forest Stewardship Council. He pointed us to a press release which says that Gunns has only embarked on a process towards certification and it will take time and a change in practices before its eligibility for certification can be evaluated. You can send us your comments on the National Interest via the website abc.net.au/rn/national interest or by calling the feedback line 1300 936 222. The National Interest is produced by Erica Voles, technical production this week by Paul Penton. I'm Peter Mayers, and on ABC Radio National, it's coming up to the news.
He's one of Canada's finest, a leading essayist and writer of highly influential books like The Unconscious Civilization. John Ralston Saul has focused our attention on the way that reason and thinking have been used and misused to run inflexible economic ideologies that are anti-democratic. So where does this passion come from? The making of John Ralston Saul. Download or stream this program on The Book Show from the Radio National website.